This is a lecture entitled Life Beyond Life and Death. It was given by Swami Ashokananda in 1951. It is very difficult unless we have become free to a certain extent of our identification with the body, to imagine what our true existence is. In our so-called normal state, our existence is identified with life, and we oppose it to the state of death, that is, another existence opposed to the conditions of our living existence. Innumerable difficulties follow from this view. To begin with, we are afraid of death. We are afraid of our decay. When we begin to lose the bloom of youth, we do not like it. When our body becomes ill and old age overtakes us, we do not like it. And strenuous are the efforts we make to stay, to avoid the oncoming of age. Everything around us we interpret in terms of life. Our relationship with others and the objectives we set for ourselves are all interpreted in terms of living. Yet, however perfect our life is here, it must end. I imagine there are some who say that they have lived a full life. Even if we agree with them, we know that death will overtake them, and that which had been so beautiful, so satisfying, so perfect in their own estimate will be brought to an end. Men have dreamt of that kind of life, and so they have figured out that even after death, there may come another existence in the heart of death itself, so-called everlasting life, in which they will continue this perfect existence. Of course, for the majority of people, this has not been a perfect existence. For them, death would be a fulfillment of the dream that was not realized here. The life on the other side of death has been called heavenly existence. Many think that this ideal condition will be ours after we have died. And thus, for eternity, we shall go on living happily, never suffering from all the troubles which pester us here. As I have oftentimes told, it is high time that we wake up from these rather childish dreams of the afterlife. Life is earnest, your poet Longfellow has said. Yes, life is earnest, but not in the grim sense. Rather, in the sense that there is a profound depth to life. Life is not right, nor can it be in any way satisfying if we are not able to probe into those depths. It is no use misunderstanding and mistaking everything and building up a scheme of life on the basis of superficial understanding. It is not right to have these pictures of the afterlife in terms of this existence. That is not it. We feel that in India we have been fortunate in this respect. Don't think that I'm trying to be boastful about that country. No, you must admit that it is just proper that I make a frank acknowledgement of the fact that from very ancient times it has been impressed upon our minds that there might be heavens and hells, but the real existence, that everlasting so-called life, has nothing to do with either life or death. It is beyond both. After all, India has sacrificed everything else in order to gain and perpetuate this knowledge. And so it deserves to have a better understanding. No other country has given so much energy, so much of its interest to understanding spiritual problems and to finding their solution. In this understanding lies our salvation, because it is illumination, enlightenment. It is finding that which we have been seeking, knowingly or unknowingly. And in that finding, in that seeking, is eternal fulfillment, complete fulfillment. Yes, there is no doubt about it. There is something having which one can be completely fulfilled. You may say, yes, we also think that we are fulfilled sometimes, but later we find that we were mistaken. This fulfillment I am speaking of has not even the possibility of any ending, because it is not of time, therefore it cannot change. And this life beyond life and beyond death has nothing to do with life or death, nothing to do with whether we are living or dying. They say in India that we should be able to realize that state even now, since it has nothing to do with the conditions of life or death. We can transcend those conditions, and by the same token, we can realize this other thing, which, for lack of a better word, I have called life. But it is not really life in any sense in which it is spoken of here. There is a way by which this life beyond life and beyond death can be realized. It is not something blind or something which comes to you through the grace of God. Of course, through the grace of God, everything may come. But it is not dependent upon that grace, because it is yours already, always. Even when you are unaware of it, you have it. This is the existence which is called the spiritual being, the spiritual existence. And when a person realizes the goal of his spiritual life, he attains to this condition. He cannot speak about it when he is realizing it, because it is beyond speech. He cannot even form a concept of it, because it is beyond the mind. If you wonder how we know that we have it, since it cannot be spoken of and cannot be conceived, I shall just remind you that there is another knowledge, which is neither of the senses nor of the mind, but of the spirit itself. According to our philosophers, even ordinary knowledge is dependent upon a little bit of what we call in Sanskrit chit, spiritual knowledge, spiritual consciousness. Chit makes our present knowledge possible, makes it consistent, logical, rational. Had it not been for that, we should not know how to distinguish the rational from the irrational. It is that magic light which, when it is cast upon a thing, makes it appear as consistent and logical. When that light is withdrawn, then that which appeared as rational appears as nothing. Certainly, it appears as irrational. Well, we should try to grasp that spiritual knowledge. Our existence here is for that purpose, because all of us are seeking truth. You cannot deny, however, that we are going round and round in a circle, and do not know what we are thinking about and what we are doing, although we seem to be living a meaningful life. I say seem because we have drawn a circle beyond which we do not wish to look. The moment we shall look beyond it, our little existence within this circle will appear as completely inconsistent. We shall be forced then to find the logical consistency or connection between our limited existence and the larger existence we have become aware of. But somehow, by a peculiar twist of our mind, we have created a sort of blindness within ourselves and pay no attention to that which is just immediately clear and near. If we were to see the whole of existence in one glance, we should find that this small life holds no meaning at all. Do you think you will live this life if, as you do and evaluate it as you do, if you think of death? Just consider that. If I expect to die tomorrow morning, shall I stand before you now and give a lecture? At once my attitude will be different. Swami Vivekananda used to say that the moment he felt there was a possibility of death, his mind would at once plunge into the depths of spiritual consciousness. That is what will happen. You will not be living as you do now. Your present way of life will become utterly meaningless. Besides, consider this. If you did not identify yourself with this body, would you think, oh, this is my mother, this is my father, this is my husband, this is my wife? No. You may tell me, well, this is a religious way of talking. I'm not talking either religiously or irreligiously, nothing of the kind. I do say that when a person loses even a little of this body consciousness, or as we speak of it, dehatma buddhi, that is to say, the feeling that this body is the self, the moment he loses it, his feeling about himself at once changes. He won't think that he had been born. It is very hard to say I have been born when, to even a little extent, the body consciousness is gone. I am not speaking of a logical inference. It is a direct feeling. All of us, in the name of religion, get excited about spiritual feeling and this and that. We do not know what we are talking about as long as we have this body consciousness. If you lose even a little bit of that body consciousness, what do you care if the body is ill or well? It is as it were you had thrown away some rags. Would you even remember them? No. So you see, all the infinite relationships we have established become at once insignificant, meaningless. And by the same token, old age becomes meaningless. It really doesn't matter if all decay takes place. It doesn't matter if the skin gets wrinkled. There was a saint in Varanasi. He was an illumined soul and also a great scholar. And many people, even from Western countries, used to come and sit at his feet. Some of the Hindu princes were his disciples, and they built a marble palace for him, but he used to live there absolutely without clothing, never a single bit of cloth on his body, even though Varanasi can become extremely cold in winter. Holy men like him are not easily available. But he was just there in Varanasi, and people could go and look at him. What a keen face he had, and what a beautiful smile. The body does not really matter. I tell you that this is just a this is not just a wild utterance of Oriental idealism. No, it is not. Think if it is not rational. If you were the body, then why would it leave you at the time of death? Tell me this. Could the body leave you if it were really an integral part of your own being? Of course, you could take the attitude that nothing of you remains after the body disintegrates, and then I would not argue with you. Let us admit that there is an eternal essence and that that is our real being. If you believe that, then you know the body cannot be an essential part of you. The body comes and goes just like a garment. If you have begun to think the body as essential, then somewhere an illusion has been built up for you and you have been caught in that illusion. The sooner you can break this illusion, the better. You will find that not a single religion worth the name teaches in one form or another that we should learn to separate ourselves from the body. The spirit alone remains, the body goes, the spirit is our real being. This spirit, by its very definition, is unchangeable and eternal, the finest of all existences. We all recognize that there must be some unchangeable substance somewhere, because we know that change cannot be perceived except in relation to something that does not change. Some say that the stationary thing is not really unchanging, it is only changing less. If that were so, then how do we have the illusion that it is stationary, unchanging? There must be something within us which has the concept of the unchanging, and that is why it makes the less changing for the unchanging. And if this unchanging is not in the outside, it is at least in the inside, that is, in the essence of our identity, which remains with us and affirms itself every moment, even though the body changes and the mind changes and external conditions change. This sense must be based on something which is identical through all the passage of time. Of course, you could find defects in this argument. And if we have to defend the unchanging by an argument alone, we are vulnerable to sharp intellects. Though I am not quite sure of that, because they themselves are not without. All these arguments, other arguments, are not without their holes. But you see, this argument is confirmed by spiritual experience. That which is indicated by observation, or at least implied by reasoning, that is confirmed by actual experiences that can be had. This is the spiritual experience which reveals itself, which reveals the self, the soul in man, the deathless, immortal, unchanging self. You know, if we have even a little glimpse of this immortal self, there comes a revolutionary change in our existence. All our relationships with others become nothing when we become aware of our true existence, our spiritual existence. It would be a terribly nihilistic business had it not been that as we lose this consciousness of our relationships, another consciousness takes its place, much more important, much more real, and much more responsible. Some people have an idea that if somehow, either by thought or by imagination or by some other means, they throw off their worldly responsibilities, they can escape. Such are called escapists. Only the ignorant use such words. They know nothing about it. I have not found a single person who understands spiritual life ever saying that attaining spiritual consciousness is escapism. Those who use such language are absolutely ignorant spiritually. As these responsibilities go and relationships are abrogated, they are replaced by other tremendous responsibilities, because instead of looking upon someone as your son or your daughter, you see God himself there. And what would you say about your relationship to God? Do you think you can escape from that? No. When you recognize God, that eternal responsibility and the duty you owe to God cannot be measured in any way, because when you have given your very all, you yet still feel that you have not done enough. This is the responsibility that takes hold of you. Instead of a few people, you feel that the whole world is your responsibility, and in a much deeper sense than you had ever thought of. So our relationships with others change. It is not merely to tell you these destructive things that I'm mentioning this fact, but because it should be known. The Upanishads, Atmanam Vidhi, know thyself. We should know ourselves. How can we know what is our duty or what we should aim at if we do not know ourselves? And for that matter, how can we do anything for others if we do not know them? So knowledge is essential, and this knowledge will lead us to this life of which I am speaking, the life which is beyond life and death. The way to reach this knowledge is a very simple procedure, but of course to follow it is not so simple. I admit this, it is difficult, but only in the sense that it requires persistence. No doubt about it, if you are persistent, you accomplish something. But if you are not persistent, if you give up, or if you are half-hearted, then you should not expect success either. What is this process? Shankaracharya prescribes negating everything you can. Suppose you can say, I am not the body. Then say it. Say it. It is true. You are certainly not the body. Look at someone else's body. Or if it is not too grim to mention, look at a dead body and think, am I that? In imagination, think whether we should call body by itself what you are. No, you are not that. And you must admit that our consciousness of our body is not really of the body at all. That's the strange part of it. We cannot even perceive parts of our own body. Has anyone been able to see his own eyes? It is an odd thing. You see, when I say I am the body, all I am sure of is that I have body consciousness. I have a mode of consciousness which is called body. So far as I'm concerned, that's it. But then I get mixed up and think I must be like the bodies I see outside. I see those bodies moving and blinking and dancing and grinning and doing all sorts of things. I begin to think maybe I also have this. And I look at the mirror, but there I am cheating myself. If I were the body really, how is it that I know nothing about my body? A body is a profound mechanism. Things take place in it, which do not wait for my permission, nor am I aware of many of them. It is certainly, the body is certainly a foreign land. No, I am not the body. If you say, well, you may say that, but you're still stuck with the body. I admit that. but I won't admit it always, no. If you think you have cornered me, I shall not remain cornered. A time will come when I shall mean it, when I say that I am not the body. If you ask, how do you know that? I know it. I have seen people who know it. Actually, you become free of the body. You feel separate from the body. Then what happens to the body does not communicate itself to you. Do you know that? A state comes as you grow in this consciousness of separation from the body. When sense perceptions come to you, sensations come to the eyes and to the ears, bodily sensations come, but they stop short. They cannot cross a certain gap. And as it were, you are on the other side of that gap. You can see them, but they cannot affect you in any way. It is like being in a zoological garden, the modern type of zoo, where the wild animals are on the other side of a moat, and you are on this side. You see them moving, but they cannot reach you. Exactly like that, you feel there has been a gap which cannot be bridged at all by the body or the sensations of the body and the senses. The body might have this or that, but you are seeing something not belonging to you at all. It is a very odd perception, but this perception does come. Now you will ask me, then why is it that we feel so mixed up with the body? And some of you will say that our existence itself is made up of the contributions of the body. If I were to think of my own existence as devoid of the body and what transpires in and through it, my self-consciousness, my whole being would become exploded thereby. Nothing to fear. As a matter of fact, your so-called existence, which is mixed up with the body, has mixed you up a great deal. And you have no idea how wonderful, how glorious your own real existence is. You cannot form any idea of what it is like when you get rid of body consciousness. No, it is not true that your growth, your very self, is dependent upon the body and the contributions made through the body. One should not make that mistake. But if you ask me still, why is it that we are so mixed up? I shall tell you why you are. You see, for some mysterious reason, nobody knows why, you also don't know why, you have decided that this material reality, this physical reality, is the true reality. Somehow you have made up your mind that this is so. That is what our philosophers have called Maya or illusion. But as long as it is there, we judge everything in terms of material or physical existence. There is no reason why we should do that. But because we do, we try to know this physical existence, which is extending outside of us infinitely and indefinitely, and revealing itself in infinitely various forms. Therefore, we are dependent upon the body. We are one with the body, and the body also has evolved the senses to communicate with the so-called physical reality. And the whole thing, of course, is a mixed-up affair. As long as you have the consciousness that this is the real, you cannot escape this condition of being mixed up with the body, however hard you reason. You may reason, but you will get no farther than a rational conclusion. Your experience will remain the same. Sri Ramakrishna used to say that the almanac tells you that there will be so many inches of rain in such and such a month. But if you squeeze the almanac, squeeze the page, not a drop of water comes out. You may reason and reason, but not the slightest particle of reality is there, just ideas and concepts. And as long as we are bound up with this kind of illusory idea that this is the real, we are being held here. If you say, why, we are also aware of the mind, we certainly can't think that this body alone is the real. No, my friends, you don't accept the mind to be real. You look upon the mind as a phase of this physical existence. To be a materialist would be the true philosophy for you. You would be more true to your present nature, though not true as regards your inferences and conclusions. Mind by itself, mind as a reality, is not perceived until we have become free of reality in terms of matter. As long as we are here, mind is a slave of matter, and therefore materialists often claim that mind is nothing but an after effect of matter, and they are right. Insofar as their philosophy is concerned, they are right. I have no regard for those people who look upon the body as solid reality and yet at the same time glorify the mind, because they do not know that even in their highest flights of idealism, that mind is tied to matter. That idealism is such a weak thing that it is no idealism at all. I know of a person who realized the state in which he became considerably free of this body consciousness. And a strange experience came to him. He said that he then understood what is meant by true idealism when reality is spoken of as idea, or as you would say, as mind. He found that everything was made up of ideas, of the mind stuff. Trees, stones, men, birds, beasts, sky, all were mind stuff and not matter at all. It was not that he perceived this in a kind of meditation, it was just in the ordinary state. And that experience lasted for quite a long time. He recognized that even that was not the highest reality. But he found, I should say, that he was closer to spiritual reality than before he realized that state. The presence of God was more vivid to him at that time. Yes, I maintain this. Because we have desires, desires which are satisfied in terms of the body or the senses, and because we want to experience reality in terms of the senses, we have made matter the criterion of reality, and therefore we are being held here. It is a sort of vicious circle. By perceiving reality in terms of matter, we conceive matter as material, and the one strengthens the other. Therefore, teachers of religion instruct us that we should try to give up material desires as far as we can. That will make us comparatively free of our bondage to matter. And then they have said, even where we have to fulfill those material desires, we should inject into them the consciousness of something higher. And by this means, we shall become free of this slavery to material desires. And when we have become a little free of this slavery to material desires, we shall find that what we had desired is not real. It will become tenuous to us. More and more, it will assume the aspect of unreality. Whereas that is a negative analysis, or rather negative statement of an aspect of this realization, I may say that in the positive aspect, we begin to become aware of another reality which we had never felt before. Something within us that is deeper than the mind and above the mind begins to assert itself. That is the soul, the spirit. You may say that it is not really spirit yet. Yes, presumably you would be right. But you don't really feel, at that time, you really feel a deeper reality within yourself. And the moment you begin to feel this deeper reality, you will also perceive in others the presence of that same reality. Do you know this, that the outside is nothing but our own reflection? It is, as it were, we are standing before a vast mirror, and we ourselves are being reflected in it. Yes, that's it. If we cry, this world also cries. And if we smile, it also smiles. If I think myself to be physical, the world also appears to be physical. If I perceive myself as mental, you will also all appear to be as mental beings. If I perceive myself as the soul, I shall perceive you as the soul. So we reach a condition where we do not blame anybody anymore. We do not find fault with anyone anymore. We say that to do that is really to put our own blame on others. We then come to realize that we do not know what is in the so-called outside. We had been taking for granted that there is this and there is that and there is something else. Now we no longer think that way. You see, although we think of reality in terms of matter, we try to think of it in an infinite way, because we are infinite by our very nature. We see reality as spreading in infinite space, changing in infinite time, and having infinite variety, all because of the infinity of our own nature. And of course, as long as we think in terms of matter, we also perceive reality in this material form. But as we begin to go inward and perceive that this being is not material, but one unchanging spirit, oddly enough, the varieties of forms we see outside become minimized. It is the interior unity of all things, the identity of all things, which becomes more and more manifest. Also, we find that things are not changing so much. It is the forms that change, and now our attention is not so much attracted by forms. Forms, as it were, begin to fade away. As the substance of this inner being is seen as less and less changeful, our sense of time and space become lessened. In other words, outwardly also we begin to see the presence of the spirit. Now, as we look upon this process as it goes on, I must here tell you where the jurisdiction of death stops and where the condition beyond death and above death comes in. As long as we feel that we are this body, we are under the power of death. And we shall suffer untold agonies because of physical changes and the ultimate change, which is called death. Birth is painful, death is painful, all changes of the body are painful. When the little one, the little baby, is growing up, his body aches all over. He has growing pains. For a short space of time, he seems to be comfortable, and then decline begins. He doesn't like to see his freshness going away, but however much he polishes his own skin, it is no longer so fresh as before. the bloom is wearing off. Then come diseases and troubles, and of course everybody knows how painful old age is. You cannot work as much as before, and if you do, you suffer from consequences. Then finally comes death. They say that for those who have been very much attached to physical things, death can be exceedingly painful. One cannot always judge from the exterior of the dying person, because as you know, after some time or under certain conditions, the face cannot express what goes on in the mind. When the nerves become dull, nothing is expressed on the surface. Only when the nerves are sensitive does the face have expression. We also know many people who have what is called unchangeable or poker faces. You don't know what is actually going on in their mind. Well, it is said that you really do not know what is going on in the mind of the dying person. The general belief is, in India, is that if a person has been worldly, his passing out of the body is painful. And they say further that it is a blessing, actually, to suffer from illness before death. Because of a long illness, a person somehow gets free of the body. And when this great moment comes, the moment of departure, it is easier for him to become separated from the body than if death had come suddenly. In any case, you can understand why they think the way they do. If it is true that we have become identified with the body, we have the consciousness that we are the body, and then we have to be separated from the body, it is bound to be exceedingly painful. And if I put it conversely, you will also understand. If a piece of the body is separated from me, say you pull out a few hairs, I shall consider it painful. If a piece of skin gets cut off for some reason, it is painful. But after all, it is the same process as dying. Whichever way you describe it, whether some portion is taken simply like this or the whole altogether. Many religions, therefore, have emphasized preparation for death. They say, think of death, prepare yourself for it, and they will sing songs about the awesomeness of death. In Christianity, in the olden days, some devout people used to actually make a coffin and sleep in it as a preparation for death. It is said of Charles V, the emperor, the Holy Roman Emperor, that in his later days he used to sleep in a coffin. Probably today you would call this rather unnatural or morbid. Well, in one sense it was. But I would not blame them. I would say that to think this life is all and go on prancing around is actually silly, because people, mature people, should not act so superficially. If one is morbid, the other is silly, but the spiritual effect of emphasizing preparation for death is very good. As you will find in the Gospel of Sri Ramakrishna, Sri Ramakrishna himself would say, try to think of God now. Make a habit of remembering God, because then, at the time of death, the mind will instinctively remember God, and that will alleviate the misery of death. Further, as a result of your recollection of God at the time of death, your afterlife will be better than otherwise. Of course, even if you think of God only as a preparation for death, there is bound to be the other effect. You will become more spiritual. But religions have emphasized this preparation because they've recognized the awesomeness of death, the suffering it causes, how in one moment it negates everything you have done in your whole life. You amassed wealth, you build up friends and relatives, you did many good deeds, you acquired learning. In one moment, all have been left behind. You will not be able to touch them anymore, so long as this condition of being is tied, being tied to the body remains, death will remain a painful experience. But you can get free of this body. They say that apart from the conquest of desires, which is absolutely necessary, one should also learn to practice meditation, because meditation is a sovereign means by which one can feel most intensely his own real state. As Swami Vivekananda used to say, in meditation alone, we truly exist. We exist at our best. You may say, well, however it may be, but it cannot be called a natural state of existence. One cannot sit with closed eyes all the time. Well, why do you have to close your eyes? There is one form of meditation, or rather difficult form, it is true, in which a person does not close the eyes or any senses at all. Furthermore, if you have become established in meditation, then even when you are not deliberately meditating, part of your mind is still in the state of meditation. To do the things we ordinarily do on the surface of existence, only a little part of the mind is actually necessary. And even when we are doing very thoughtful things which demand greater concentration, not too much of the mind is required. There is a larger mind, a vastly larger mind, which we are not using. It is like a country where the people have cultivated only a small portion of their land, whereas if they cultivated their waste tracts, not only would they live handsomely on the harvest, but they would also be able to feed others. So there is a vaster mind which we know nothing about, beyond the so-called unconscious mind, which troubles us and is full of all sorts of unpleasant things. It is a supermind in which there is no activity at all. It is transparent and shines with the glory of the Spirit. That part of the mind doesn't do anything because it is causal, just as a seed, the cause of a plant, is inactive. This causal mind in itself is inactive. Only a little of the mind has become the subtle mind and is serving the body. And that causal part has remained without losing its identity. When you have learned to meditate, meditation consists in forgetting the external world and for the time being sending the servants out of the way, out, so the house is quiet. The senses have quieted down. That is why you close your eyes in meditation. The subtle mind, of course, is still running its races, and you learn to stop it from running. In two ways it is done. One way is to attain to a state of complete negation, complete calmness of mind, which in most cases is actually a dangerous thing to do. If you are not free of worldly desires, it may create a lesser condition rather than a state of meditation. In that case, such negative practice is not good. The other process is to give the mind the very highest on which to dwell and with which to wrestle. That is why God is most often the object of meditation, or perhaps a divine attribute, something of the nature of eternity, or eternal being, or eternal reality. Sometimes when one is unable to feel the presence of God directly, he takes on an image or a symbol as an object of meditation, either of which has some aspect which is similar to the divine existence. One concentrates on that image or that symbol and shifts the mind to that divine attribute. Gradually, the mind forgets the immediate image or symbol and begins to concentrate upon God. Mind has the biggest thing of all to wrestle with there. And so all this movement, all this running around of the mind stops at once. Sometimes when you give a bad boy a responsibility, he becomes a good boy. He had too much energy and nothing to apply it to. But someone has found out that he really wants to accomplish something and gives it to him. Then his whole mind goes to it and his whole character becomes straightened out. That is true of the mind also. And it should happen in most cases, certainly. In meditation, that is what happens. You give the mind the very best, that which contains all that the mind has been striving after. And therefore, the mind goes after it and struggles to comprehend and eventually to realize it, to perceive it. Then you find the sense world is left behind, the body is left behind. You actually go deeper and deeper, and the spirit consciousness, the consciousness of the spirit, grows vivid within you. By this means, you find desires also become attenuated. They are undermined. No longer have they power over you. Om Yau Shantihi Antariksham Shantihi Prithivi Shantihi Apo Shanti Roshadaya Shantihi Vanaspataya Shantihi Vishve Deva Shantihi Brahma Shanti Sarvam Shanti Shanti Reva Shanti Same Shanti Redhi Om Shanti Shanti Shanti. Om, peace is in heaven, peace is in the sky, on the earth and in the waters. The herbs, the plants, and the trees are full of peace. The gods are peaceful. Everything in the universe is pervaded by peace. May that infinite universal peace enter our soul and being. Oh, peace, peace, peace be unto us all.